Hello, this is Zsófilter, the feminist podcast of Partizan, an independent media channel in Hungary. My name is Zsófi Balogh, and my guest today is Renate van der Zee, Dutch writer and investigative journalist who specializes in women's rights issues. She has authored many articles and several books about violence against women, prostitution, refugee women's struggles, honor killings, and female genital mutilation. She is currently researching about victims of the porn industry from Eastern Europe who are trafficked to the Netherlands. She has written for The Guardian and Al Jazeera English and several Dutch newspapers and magazines. Our international listeners, welcome to Partizan's podcast channel. You can find out more about us on our YouTube and social media platforms. And if you can, please support our work through our Patreon. Hi, Renate. Welcome.
Hi, Sophie. I'm so honored to be here.
I'm so glad that you are visiting Budapest at this time. The reason you are here is you were attending Szombathely Hungary Association's event.
Yeah.
I don't know when this episode will air, but we are on the 18th of October. The event was yesterday, and you were presenting your latest investigation about these victims that I was talking about in the intro. The thing that people have in their minds about the Netherlands, I think, at least in Hungary, is maybe two things. First, legalize weed. And then the second is the sex trade.
Yeah.
You know, the red light district. For average people, it's some kind of, you know, tourist attraction or tourist destination for both these topics. But of course, you have been researching this, that what goes behind the red light district and all this shiny thing that they sell people as something,
it's a big lie.
Yeah, nice and liberal, the modern West, so to speak.
There's nothing liberal about it. It's all about exploitation of women.
Right. So please tell us about what you've been working on.
Well, what happened in Holland is in 2000, the government has legalized brothel keeping. And we all thought it was a fantastic move. It was very liberal. It was very progressive. The idea was if we legalize prostitution, then women in prostitution can become, you know, their own bosses and exploitation will stop. The reality is that it became, in a way, easier for human traffickers to exploit women, because under the guise of legalization, everything turned out to be possible. And it was sort of naive that we legalized prostitution in 2000, and then some years after, Eastern European borders opened up. And all kinds of men, traffickers from Eastern European countries, also Hungary, went to Amsterdam to ply their trade. Like, I started to investigate the sex industry about 15 years ago. And this happened, almost by coincidence. I was thinking, what is the most terrible way to be forced into something, to lose your freedom. And then I thought, that must be forced prostitution. And I thought, God, how is a woman going to survive forced prostitution? And in order to understand that, I went to do volunteer work in a shelter for victims of human trafficking. And while I was doing the volunteer work in the shelter, I heard so many horrible stories. And at the same time, I thought, oh, yeah, but we did all right in Holland, no? We legalized prostitution and it was all fine and it was all liberal and progressive. How can it be that there's so many victims of these horrible stories? You know, women who came from poor, low-wage countries who were locked up in a room without food and drink until they consented to do prostitution. Women who were not allowed to use condoms of their pimps, so they some of them had HIV, some of them had children, didn't know where the children came from. A lot of violence. The stories were harrowing. So then I thought, oh, if this happens in our wonderful liberated prostitution sector, what is really going on there? So I investigated the red light district of Amsterdam, and I simply, really simply, I just went out and I just knocked on the window.
Wow.
and, And I just started talking with women. And I started talking with everybody who knew anything about it.
Were they open to talk to you?
No. But you need to invest. So, I mean, you can go in there and for one time, and then the woman behind the window will say, oh, yeah, I'm fine with it. I chose this myself, and I'm earning a lot of money, and I'm really doing well. And then if you invest in it and you see her, maybe you get the chance to see her outside of the windows, or you see her during years, then finally you find out that maybe there was a pimp after all. Or maybe she had been abused in her childhood. And then all of a sudden in the conversation she says, yeah, you know, you have to turn the switch to do this work. And then all of a sudden she will say, but for me it was easy because I learned how to do it when my father abused me as a child. And then you get to know the real stories. So I found out there's a lot of exploitation. Behind every red light there's a tear.
Right. And of course, the red light district is just part of this industry. But I remember going there. We were visiting Amsterdam with a school trip and we had some free time. So, of course, we wanted to go there and see what's that about.
Of course.
But it was just so strange and weird to see women standing as objects in a window and just standing there. I don't think there's more obvious way of objectification than to stand in a window for people in your underwear to see.
Absolutely.
And to be bought for the hour.
Absolutely. I mean, how can a country like the Netherlands pretend to be a liberated country if they have women from low-wage countries standing in their underwear in a window for men to look at and to buy for 50 euros? I mean, how can you really think that you are a liberal country, that you are an emancipated country when you allow this to happen? When you even say, okay, well, let's legalize it. Okay, the whole idea behind legalization was good, but it was totally naive. And even politicians have said so. There was a politician, Lodewijk Asscher, who said we were naive in doing this. And yeah. And of course, the sex industry is not going to be without any coercion and without any exploitation if you legalize it. No, it's going to be the other way around. Because in the sex industry, there's so much money to be made.
Right.
But there will always be criminals who take advantage of the women. And so that's what I found out. But, you know, many people don't want to listen to this.
Right. And you have done a lot of interviews with victims and pimps as well,
Yeah, pimps as well.
And also, just to stay with the red light district topic for a second more, is it true that the streets are kind of divided by nationalities? Like in one of the Al Jazeera reports, it said that like there's a street for, you know, Hungarian women. There's a street for this kind of women.
Well, it's not officially.
Right.
It's not officially, but there have been different phases.
Mm-hmm.
Like around, maybe I'm mistaken, but I think it was around 2008 or 2010, we had the Hungarian time.
Mm-hmm.
So there were so many Hungarian pimps coming with Hungarian women, really young women. Because I think in those times it was still allowed to be 18. Now the age went up to be 21.
Mm-hmm.
So there was one street, and that was called the Hungarian Street. And there were only Hungarian women, really young women from really poor backgrounds. And there have been some cases, I read the dossiers of the court cases. So I really know inside information of what's going on there. And what's really going on there, the women were not only exploited by the pimps, but they were also exploited by the people who rent out the rooms.
Okay.
These are different people.
Okay.
You have the pimps that exploit the women, and you have people who rent the rooms that earn money from the rent from the rooms.
Who is paying for the room?
The woman.
The woman. So she is owed to two separate people now. She's
absolutely.
She's dependent on the pimp and on the owner.
The owner of the window will say, if you don't, if you want to have a day off tomorrow, you have to pay for the room. Otherwise, I'll give it to somebody else.
Wow.
And you won't get it back. And these kind of things. Or, and I read in those dossiers, I read how these women were exploited from different sides. And also there was a cafe in this street where there were video screens in the back. So the pimps could just sit in the cafe and look on the video screens what was going on. So if the ladies were doing their jobs according to their rules.
Oh my God.
It was amazing. Yeah, it was.
The listeners can't see, but my jaw dropped.
I mean, so that was that. It's true. That street was called the Hungarian Street.
Wow.
And, well, we had lots of tragedies happening with Hungarian women in the red light district. There was also a young woman who had a little boy, and she was brutally murdered in her room with a guy with a knife in the middle of the night. And he was never caught.
Right. Just like any other work, they say.
It's sex work is work.
Wow.
That's what they say.
That's
why I never use the word sex work, because it isn't sex and
right.
It isn't work.
Right. Absolutely.
Yeah.
So how do these women get there? What have you uncovered? And of course, we can meanwhile get into the connection to the porn industry or how this is sold sometimes as a porn job or a modeling job. But just take us through how do these girls, women end up in the red light district or in the Netherlands in prostitution?
Well, it's like most of these women come from really poor backgrounds. A lot of them come from Eastern Europe. A lot of them from Hungary, from Romania, Bulgaria. And, you know, there's one day this guy pops up and says, hi, you're a very pretty girl. If you want, you can earn a lot of money in Amsterdam. So how about it? And the girl thinks, oh, if it's that easy, maybe I can go just for half a year or something and earn some money so I can pay for the operation of my sick mother. So often these guys also pose like they're in love with the girls and that there's a relationship. And then she comes to Holland, and then the guy says, yeah, but now you have to go, you have to start paying me because I paid for your trip and I paid for your outfit and I paid for the hotel and I paid for this and I paid for that. And funny enough, the paying never stops.
Mm-hmm.
So the woman is there and she's, you know, she's behind the window and sometimes not behind the window. Sometimes they do it with internet prostitution, because it's the red light district is only a small fraction of what's going on in prostitution, you know, and she just has to keep on paying. And the moment that she says, hey, what's going on here? There might be violence or there might be manipulation. He says, I've got pictures of you, or I'm going to tell your family, or we know where your sister lives. So they can't get out of it. What is also very interesting is people always tend to think that exploitation in the sex industry is a question of a lot of violence and that the woman is tied with a chain. This is not true. Most of the cases that I have known, there are cases that are very violent and terrible, but a lot of cases, the women are just manipulated. Mm-hmm. And often the pimp gives them like 50 euros or 100 euros a week so they can send some money to their family. And they themselves will find it hard to see themselves as exploited. This makes it so confusing because when a woman says, no, I'm not exploited, this is my boyfriend. And then people say, well, you know, nothing is wrong. In the meantime, the guy is just, you know, he's driving around in a Porsche.
Yeah.
And she doesn't have anything to show for it.
Yeah. And a lot of exited women who have exited prostitution say that, of course, when you are working for a pimp or exploited by a pimp, you have to justify it for yourself as well. And you will defend him and you will defend what you are doing Absolutely. In any way you can.
Absolutely. I found that so often in all the talks that I had, or in many talks that I had with women in prostitution, while you're in prostitution, you are in a very difficult situation. And the only way that you can go on doing it is by telling yourself that it's okay. And that you're fine, that he is your lover, and that you're looking after him, and that it's all hunky-dory. Because otherwise you wouldn't be able to go on. If you admit to yourself that you're being exploited, that all the money that you make is going into his car and his expensive clothes, if you admit to yourself that it's totally wrong, you can't go on. So what you're saying there, Sophie, is so insightful. And that's the reason why in Holland, we have so many journalists who are writing these stories about, you know, women that are fine in prostitution. Because they think they are wonderful reporters. They're going to the red light district. They're going to talk with a woman in prostitution. They talk for 1 hour with her. She's telling them the story that she tells herself. And then they write it down and they say, you see, there's nothing wrong in Dutch prostitution.
What about the sex work lobby? Because I bet that as the criminal activities went up after legalizing the brothel keeping, the lobby efforts must also be very strong to keep this as it is.
Yeah, it's very strong. And it is, of course, the Dutch government only gives government money to organizations that sustain the idea of legalization. And these organizations, they are good people, you know, they're not bad people. I don't agree with them, but I mean, they're not bad people. They want to do something good for the women in prostitution. And they say, you know, we have to destigmatize it. We have to normalize it. And if we normalize it, then it will become less violent and less criminal. But how, for God's sake, can you normalize something like prostitution? I mean, you can't normalize buying sex. You can't normalize a guy from a rich background paying a poor girl 50 euros so he can, you know, she can perform oral sex on him without a condom.
And even if for a second I want to take this argument seriously, I mean, almost 25 years have passed in the Netherlands.
Absolutely.
I don't believe that being a prostitute has gained any more recognition as a respectable job, so to speak.
Nothing, my dear friend, nothing has changed in the Netherlands. And the public prosecutors that I know, and one of them became a really good friend of mine because she said, yeah, what you see is the same as what I see. The public prosecutors who are in human trafficking, who are dealing with the pimps, who are sending the pimps to prison, they said to me, it's become worse. And of course, you can't say that it's become worse because of the legalization of prostitution, of brothel keeping, because you don't have the proof. There can be other influences, but they say to me that it became worse. Then again, we don't have facts and figures when it comes to prostitution, so I can't prove it. What I hear from public prosecutors, they say, well, in the 25 years, it became worse. It hasn't become better. That's one thing that's really obvious.
Right.
Yeah. So... Well, how about talking about my latest investigation?
Yes, please. So you were uncovering the story of this specific, quotes, modeling scout.
Modeling scout.
Who is basically a pimp. And yeah. His name is Daniel van der W. I don't know, his full name was not written down there.
No, let's call him Daniel.
Let's call him Daniel. So what is the deal with this guy?
Well, it's an interesting story. It started actually in 2022 when the French government issued a huge report on human trafficking and exploitation and violence in the sex trade. And because of that report, two huge court cases came out against men in porn, like producers, you know, all kinds of guys who had trafficked women, who had raped women on set. Incredible, huge cases. So that was very interesting that it happened in France. And then parliamentarians in Holland, they asked the Minister of Justice, the Dutch Minister of Justice, how about the Dutch porn industry? Are these things also going on in the Dutch porn industry? So the Minister of Justice said, okay, we'll do a small investigation and I'll let you know. So she did a small investigation, and the small investigation said nothing wrong in Dutch porn industry. We can't find anything.
Wow. Okay. Sounds so believable.
Yeah. It is. Well, the thing is, I wasn't even aware of that.
Do they take themselves seriously when they say things like that? I don't even know. Sorry. Just.
Well, you know, the bottom line is they don't give a flying F. Well, I didn't even know about that investigation. And so there was a woman who had been exploited in the porn industry. She was on Twitter and she sent me a message and she said, hey, did you see this? Can't you do anything about it? So I had a look at it. I saw that investigation. I said, what? How is it possible? And I became so angry. And, you know, I'm a little bit older. And I tried to take my life a little bit more easy. So I decided to start working part-time. And I said, well, I'm working part-time now anyway. So, you know what I'm going to do? I'm in my spare time, I'm going to investigate the porn industry.
As a hobby, as you do.
You know, I thought, well, you know, I'm gonna have a few conversations with a few people, and you know, I'm giving myself a year. I said to myself. So very quickly, I got into contact with a woman who is in prostitution and who also did some porn films. And she's a very interesting woman because she is also very intent on exposing what's going on in the sex industry. And she's extremely clever. And she said to me, well, Renate, I got a guy for you. And I said, what kind of guy? And she said, yeah, this guy is a photographer, so-called photographer, and a so-called modeling scout. And he is inviting all these women from Eastern Europe to come over to Holland. And I've heard really bad stories about him. I said, okay, yeah, well, that's interesting, but I don't have any proofs. And then she said, you just wait. And you know what that woman did? It was amazing. This guy, this Daniel, he put an advertisement out saying, I'm looking for a web designer to design a new website for me. And she went up to him and she's blonde and young and she has this high voice and she's sort of, she looks totally innocent, but she's the devil in disguise. So she went up to him, to his house. She went to the Lion's Den. She went to his house. And she said, hi, Daniel. Yeah, I'm a web designer. Wow. And I work also in the sex industry. And I think it would be really fantastic if I could design your website. And he was only looking at her blonde hair and curvaceous body and not really thinking about anything else. And he gave his hard disk to her. His full hard disk. And the next day, you know where the hard disk ended up.
At your place.
On my desk.
Wow.
This woman, I mean, really, it's like a film, isn't it?
It is like a film.
It's like a film. So then, okay, I put the hard disk in my computer. I couldn't believe what I saw. It was like photographs, names, addresses, telephone numbers of 400 women.
Oh my God.
In 20 years' time, this guy trafficked 400 women to the Netherlands. So then, I mean, my work started. I started contacting women. This is very difficult because, you know, you remind them of a time that maybe they don't want to be reminded of. And the interesting thing is that the women were treated differently when they were stronger and when they were more experienced, and when they were a little bit older, I spoke to a few women who said, oh, we were treated okay. Mm-hmm. But then I also spoke to women who had terrible experiences with this guy. And two of them said, okay, they were a Czech. I also talked to Hungarian women. There were also Hungarian women involved. But I went to the Czech Republic because most of the women came from the Czech Republic. And I talked to these women, and the way it would go would be like this. Either they would get all out of the blue, they would get some kind of message saying, do you want to come and do modeling work in Holland? Or there would be a modeling agency who said you can do modeling work in Holland. And they would know there would be some nudity involved.
Mm-hmm.
But they wouldn't know that it would be about porn.
So they would be like, okay, there's some kind of nude photography. It's part of my modeling job sometimes.
Well, some of these women were absolute beginners.
Oh,
they were very young and they were very poor.
Okay.
So they thought, okay, you know, let's see if I can earn some money, maybe by modeling. And then the modeling agency said, okay, well, it's this Dutch photographer. You can go to Holland and you can make a lot of money. And then they would end up, he would pick them up in his car. This one lady who told me her story, she was picked up in his car. It was evening when they came to some kind of a trailer park. And they entered this trailer. And he locked the trailer and he said to her, now you're going to have sex with me.
Oh, my God.
And she said, no, I don't want to have sex with you. This is not the deal. And then he just raped her.
Ugh.
And then she couldn't go anywhere. The trailer was locked. She didn't know where she was. It was night. She didn't have any money. So the next day he said to her, okay, now you're going to make porn movies. And she would say, no, this is not the deal. I wouldn't do porn movies. I would just do some nude photography. And he would start screaming and say, if you don't do what I say, I will kill you. Now, this woman was, in a way, she was lucky because she had to do porn movies. And there was one actor who had a heart. And he saw that she had been crying. And he said to her, what's going on? And she said, well, you know, I don't want to do this. I'm forced to do this. And then he said to her, listen, I'm going to help you. And he called up a lady who has a modeling agency in the Czech Republic. And that is a very strong lady. She called Daniel up and she said, if you don't bring that woman back to the Czech Republic right now, I'm going to inform the police.
Mm.
So he had to bring her back. That was her luck. But I mean, she was raped and she was abused. And she told me that after all these years, she never told her husband because she felt that she had been unfaithful to him.
Oh.
Yeah, by being raped.
Oh, my God.
Yeah. And her mother, she tells her mother everything, but she never told her mother because she didn't want to burden her mother with this story. And then after the interview, I said to her, listen, can I talk to you as a woman, not as a journalist, but just as a woman? And I said, you have to talk with somebody about this. You can't keep it for yourself. And then she looked at me and she said, well, that's what I just did. It was heartbreaking.
Oh, my God. So 400 women.
Yeah. And some of them managed to be okay. Some of them were just only used in Harvey Weinstein method. Like one of the Hungarian women I spoke to start with, she just went to do some nude photography and she was a very strong-willed woman. So she sort of managed to put him on his place and nothing really bad happened. And then he said, if you want to earn more money, if you want to come back, you have to do porn.
Mm.
And she needed the money, and so she decided to do porn.
Mm-hmm.
But if you decide to do porn, many people don't understand that you only want to do the things that you want to do, and you don't want to get raped by anything. Dear people, porn stars can get raped too. So then when she came back to Holland the second time, Daniel said to her, you have to have sex with me because this is the way it goes. And he put on a camera and he says, you know, this is a casting and I'm going to make... And she thought, oh, well, she was very young and not very well informed. And she thought, oh, okay, if this is the way it goes.
Oh, my God.
Then she had sex with him and several times and he made a film of it and he never paid her. And... when I talked to her, she said, yeah, it was a very bad experience. Afterwards, when I look back upon it, I think, yeah, it was a form of rape because he just took advantage of me. So that was the Weinstein method that he used on women. And then, of course, there were the women who were forced to do porn films because he really threatened them. And the second woman that I spoke in the Czech Republic, she was forced to do a gangbang.
Oh.
And he said it was the last. She came to Holland for 2 weeks, and he already forced her to do porn. And she went along with it because she really needed the money. And then the last day, he said, I have something really nice for you. You're really going to enjoy it. And then he took her to a hotel, and there was a dark room, and there were like 10 men waiting for her. And she didn't know how to escape.
Oh, God.
Yeah.
So this guy organized the Johns, the men, the buyers, the users. So he would have, I guess, a lot of contacts as well.
A lot of contacts. And the interesting thing is that the people from the professional porn industry used his ladies. Like he would ask a woman to come to Holland, like usually for a period of 2 weeks. And then he would have all these contacts, and professional porn producers would use these women in their productions. But then later on, after the introduction of internet porn, slowly his business sort of was dwindling a little bit. So what he also did was, you know, acting like it was a porn movie, but then it was just prostitution.
Okay.
So he told the woman, yeah, we're making a porn movie, and there are actors coming, and they were just, you know, prostitution clients.
Right.
So really weird things happened to the women. And in the end, there was a corona crisis in 2020, and he couldn't travel. And so he sort of had to stop. And after that, he never sort of managed to get the business going again. Because the Czech Republic, as we all know, Prague became like the capital of Eastern European sex industry. So the women, they could stay at home. If they had to be exploited in the sex industry, it could all happen at home.
Yeah.
And so some women got money from him, but he wasn't paying so much money. So in the end, the business sort of dried up. And now, it's really funny, but now he's a dishwasher in a restaurant.
I was going to ask, was he ever like prosecuted for anything or reported? Or
the amazing thing is that the police, during the 20 years that he was active, the police was on his tail. And they sort of a few times they entered the house where he was recording. Or they entered the hotel where he was recording a gangbang. And then the woman in question, of course, said, I'm doing this voluntarily.
Right.
So they had to drop it. So the police, actually, I had some conversations with the police and saying, well, why can't you prosecute him now? And I talked to the public prosecutor, and then they said, yeah, but it's already some years ago. Then how are we going to find evidence? Because if you want to have evidence against a human trafficker, you want to build your case on more than only what the victims are saying. Mm. So you want, you know, like telephone conversations, email conversations. And actually, it's going to take a lot of work. And maybe it's not even possible to get that going. So police think, okay, this one guy, well, you know, maybe if we do something else, we can have more success. So the guy goes free. That's the most amazing thing.
Yeah, yeah. And these types of guys are all over.
These guys are all over the place, these type of guys. And the funny thing is there have been women who alerted the police and who called the police and said, hey, this is going on. But, you know, human trafficking cases are often difficult and require a lot of work from the police. And there's so many crime going on. The police has to make choices. You know, I think it's terrible that he's never been prosecuted. But from a police point of view, I can somewhere also understand that it's so much work. And is there going to be a conviction? You're not even sure that there's going to be a conviction, you know. So anyway, I published my story, 6 pages, front page news. And the Minister of Justice was asked how it was possible that she had had a investigation done, and there was this little woman, you know, who was sort of almost going how you call it, on pension.
Yeah, almost retired.
Who had a look into the porn industry and who,
as a hobby, in her free time.
Interestingly, I also talked to the guy. I interviewed the guy himself.
Daniel?
Yeah.
Wow. Yeah. Okay. You have to tell me about that.
Yeah, that was interesting because, you know, we approached him if he wanted to do an interview because I had his phone number because he was threatening me. So... I said, why did you consent to an interview? He said, well... He said, you're probably not going to write anything good about me, so I might as well try and see if I can, you know, put my point of view against it. So he was very meek during that interview. And I guess he was really surprised because we knew everything. I knew everything about him. I knew the name of his dog. I mean, he said to me, like, I left the dog in my car, he said. And then I said, oh, yeah, Jimmy.
I want to see the look on his face.
He was just looking at me like... And later, somebody who knew him sent me some WhatsApp messages that Daniel had sent him. And it was said, they knew everything. They knew everything. They even knew the name of my dog.
Oh, this is so satisfying.
Well, yeah.
Just the thought of it, even though he deserves a lot worse.
He deserves a lot worse. But, I mean, at least we gave him a few sleepless nights, I'm sure about that. But in any case, it's like a film, isn't it?
It is.
It is a film. And but unfortunately for the women who went through it, it was not a film.
Mm.
And I really... one of the women that I spoke to, the one I told you the story about, that who said like she never talked about it, I felt really very sad when I, after she left, because I knew that she hadn't recovered from it. It was obvious. She was crying during the interview. Luckily, the day after, I did an interview with a woman who was forced into gangbangs, and she went into therapy and really worked on it. And she is now happily married, and she had 2 kids, and she was doing really well. So for me, for my bleeding heart, I was very happy also to see one woman who sort of survived and who was so happy that she was so happy I did the story on Daniel. And I met her in this beautiful Bohemian village. And she bought me this Czech cake. And we had coffee together. And, you know, there was some happiness. Because if you are, like, I was sort of obsessively looking into the cases of all those women for all those months on my own after behind my laptop, and all those photographs. And you look into the lives of those women. And you just think, you know, they've just been humiliated and exploited. And the Dutch government says, oh, nothing's wrong. Well, now the new Minister of Justice has announced that there's going to be a new investigation into the Dutch porn industry.
Okay.
I'm very curious to know when it's going to start,
mm-hmm.
because I haven't been called yet.
Mm. Interesting.
Yeah, very interesting. So the bottom line of this whole story is that, you know, the border between prostitution and porn is very vague. You know, you have lots of pimps that say to a woman, hey, you know, this weekend you weren't very successful. in earning enough money, let's go and do some kind of film. Or they say, yeah, you're going to do a gangbang and we're going to film it because this way we can also earn a little bit of money on the side. And so the whole, and also the professional porn business is also linked to the amateur porn business. Mm-hmm. Because to start with, this Daniel person, he was sort of an amateur. He didn't have a professional business. He was just a small-time pimp, really. Mm-hmm. And it became big because he was exploiting so many women, and also because the professional porn business used his women. So
I'm sure that the so-called professionals were happy to have this guy who would fix them with women. He would just provide it for them.
They were extremely happy with him. So everybody used him, and they didn't give shit about what was going on with these women. So everybody who likes to watch porn, you know, I would advise them to think about what's happening to the women who are in it. Because it's an exploitative business. And there's so many women in porn who commit suicide. And, you know, it is destructive.
Right.
Yeah.
Last year, I made an interview with Tommy McDonald from the porn industry.
Yeah, he's a friend of mine.
Yes, who uncovered similar things that you have uncovered. And he said that oftentimes these girls would be told, well, this film is not going to be shown in your country. This film is only going to the paid sites, so it's not going to come across anyone, you know, on the open net. But of course, as you also say in your report, this is not always the case. And often...
It's never the case.
Mm.
And because the internet is open. And the moment you put something online, it is hijacked immediately. It's pirated immediately. So you could maybe put it on a website that is sheltered.
Mm-hmm.
But once it is stolen, it is all over the place. So and also they don't really care. I mean, I read reports about a French porn producer who told these stories also to the women that he worked with, and he just didn't do it.
Mm-hmm.
He said, "Yeah, it's going to be only on a website outside of Hungary," and
that doesn't make sense.
It doesn't make sense, and they don't do it, and they don't give a shit, and they're there to profit from the women. And also, what I read the French reports. And what the women said, and that was something that really hurt me a lot. They said, I was raped and it was filmed. And every time that film is shown again, I am raped again. I am raped again and again and again.
Oh, God.
Yeah, the porn producers refused to take off the film from the internet. And then they ask a lot of money. They say, oh, if you want us to take the film away, then you have to pay us a lot of money. And often the victims don't have that money. So it stays on.
Right.
And just imagine what it means. The second lady that I talked to in the Czech Republic, who was a victim of Daniel, also told me that after she came back to the Czech Republic, she started working in all kinds of jobs. And every time somebody saw her film and showed it to all her colleagues. And then either she got like lewd remarks from her male colleagues who also wanted to have sex with her.
Oh, God.
Or her female colleagues would say that she was a prostitute. And then she felt like, you know, I have to leave this job because it's impossible for me. In the end, she decided, now everybody knows that I am a porn actress. And I can't do any job without people harassing me about it. I might as well just go into porn. So she went back into porn, but this time she made sure she only worked with producers that just paid her decently.
Mm.
And she was working in porn for like 5 years. And then people say, oh, yeah, but she chose to go back into porn.
Right, right.
And, no, she didn't choose to go back into porn. she didn't see no other solution to her problem. And also what she told me when she was working in porn, she said, I had two personas. So on the one hand, I was this person who was a porn actress, and she had another name. And the moment the filming was done, I was myself. So she just had this whole split personality. Can you imagine what it does to a woman?
That's insane. What it causes.
What it causes. I mean, the thing is, with having this different persona, it is easy to create this persona, but you can never get rid of it.
And it's a trauma response. It's a
trauma response.
It's not healthy. It's not good for anyone ever.
No. So this having a second persona means you're dissociating. Yeah. This is psychology. This is trauma. You are dissociating from what really happens. Dissociating is a great thing to do at the moment because then you don't feel the pain. Yeah. But afterwards, it's very difficult to get back to your normal self. So although this lady, as I told you, was happily married and has two little kids and she's doing well now, and she also has a lot of wounds. A lot of wounds, you know. It was a happy meeting because, you know, we had fun and she was so glad I was doing something about it. But, yeah.
But I mean, imagine the work it must have taken for her to get here and how much she still must be carrying and how much therapy it took and how much active work on herself. That's why it's so infuriating for me to hear arguments like, well, this can be just like a job like any other job. Not just because all the trauma and all the danger that these women are in and all the unpredictableness and everything and all these people who are just sucking money out of them, but also because of society, because we don't respect these women. We will not ever treat these women as any other workers. Like when you said this woman can never do a normal job again. Even if somebody finds the video, they would actively use this against her and shame her.
Yeah.
And she has to live with this for the rest of her life.
But they shame her after they masturbated to that video.
Right, right. You know? Now, this is just, I mean, we of course have to talk about pimps and what the government is doing to encourage this and all this.
Yeah, but also the users.
But the users as well. And that's what I wanted to also ask you about, because in prostitution also, the demand, the users are always in the dark. We never really talk about them too much. They are just this, you know, cloud of men somewhere who use women. But we shame the women. The women have to live with this, but the men don't have to live with the shame.
Nobody talks about the men.
Yeah.
And the women, we call them whores, and the men, we call them Johns.
Yeah, yeah.
John is the most regular word you can imagine.
Yeah, I wish there was like a shameful name for that.
Well, actually in Dutch we have one.
Yeah?
Yeah, we call them whore walkers.
Okay.
But then it's the word whore.
It's the whore again is about the woman.
Yeah, again, so I never use it. I call them sex buyers.
Right. But so have you talked to sex buyers?
Yes, I wrote a book about them.
Okay.
Yeah, so I delved into it extensively. And what I can say about sex buyers is that there isn't one type of sex buyer. I mean, sex buyers are all kinds of men. It's not a type.
The only thing that's common is that they're men.
The only thing that's common is that they're men. And the reason why they do it, the reasons why they do it are so varied. But the main reason why they do it is because they can.
So, and then we get back to the legislation part again. Because I'm wondering, during these 25 years, you know, did the demand grow? Is it more normalized among men, among society, to encourage men or to just have it, you know, in Hungary before when we had legal brothels, it was like the rite of passage for a boy to go with the dad or the granddad to be introduced to sex this way. Is it some sort of story like this in the Netherlands, that this is like a regular thing for a man to do or a group of guys?
No, I don't know. It still isn't.
Okay. So
it still isn't. But I think when we talk about porn is very normalized.
Yeah, for sure.
And most people think it's completely normal to watch porn. And almost everybody seems to watch porn. So that's very normalized, which I find extremely worrisome. Because I yesterday at the Solwodi conference, I heard that, you know, really young kids already start using porn. And then, you know, what happens to their sexuality? What happens to the sexuality of the boys who think that, you know, in order to have good sex with a woman, you need to choke her, which is also an incredible thing. And the girls who watch porn think, oh, is this what sex is about? Am I supposed to enjoy it? Or am I supposed to squirt? Because this is also something huge. I mean, it's like for women, when you watch porn, for women, sex is no longer something to be enjoyed. Yeah. I'm really old-fashioned, and I think sex is something that both people need to enjoy, and men need to, you know, educate themselves and put themselves in the place of, you know, of the provider of pleasure for the woman. But if you watch porn, it's all about humiliating the woman, hurting her. And I understand why a lot of girls sort of feel totally put off by it. But the majority of the girls, they go along with it. They think, I need to perform oral sex now because that is really the thing to do. And maybe they don't even feel like doing it, but they think if I don't do it, I'm a prude.
Yeah, and pain is sexy.
Yeah.
Feeling pain during sex is something hot.
It's hard to be choked.
Yeah, yeah.
I think porn is, it is really problematic. I don't have anything about porn if it would be, like normal sexual pleasure. I wouldn't have anything against it. I have nothing against nudity. I have nothing against sex. I'm born in the 60s, you know. We were much easier about nudity than people are nowadays. But it's all about violence, and it's all about degrading women and humiliating them.
Yeah.
I think it's very dangerous.
Yeah,
it's very dangerous.
Completely different topic for the end of our conversations, because you have done so many interesting things on other topics as well. And I'm just really curious, because I also deal with this topic a lot, that in feminist circles, at least, the Netherlands is also famous for the so-called Dutch protocol with regards to gender identity and the transgender law that you had a debate in your country in the past couple of years.
Yeah.
If you're okay to talk about this, because I find this very interesting from our perspective here, because, you know, a couple of countries have started to go against the Dutch model in terms of treating youngsters with gender identity issues and gender dysphoria and all this. And there are a bunch of different laws in Europe and in the world about how to, what kind of legalization can be put around this.
It's a very important topic. Let's start with one thing. Gender dysphoria or body dysmorphia is real. But if you look at the explosive growth of people that go to gender clinics, that the main growth is in teenage girls.
Yeah.
Many people say, "Oh, yeah, the growth is so enormous because it's more accepted." But if it was only because it's more accepted, then you would see growth in all age groups and both sexes.
Right.
But the growth is in teenage girls. And to these teenage girls, they feel uncomfortable in their bodies. And they would much prefer to be a boy.
Which is nothing new, to be honest, that they are not comfortable.
Yeah. Yeah. If you are a teenage girl, you feel uncomfortable in your body. But nowadays, and also sometimes they're lesbians and they don't want to, they find it difficult to admit it to themselves. And then they see on the internet that, you know, that maybe they're trans. And people say, well, if you feel you're trans, you're trans. And I think among this incredible growth of young girls who go to gender clinics, there are many girls who have autism. There are many girls who have eating disorder. There are many girls with depression. And I think before you start giving them hormones, puberty blockers, or putting them into a transition, look into their psychological problems, the other psychological problems first. Because maybe they are not trans. Because it is impossible that such a huge chunk of the population all of a sudden is trans.
Right.
To give them, to be really easy with puberty blockers, I think that's very dangerous. Because we found out that puberty blockers are very disputable drugs. Because what do? They stop the most important development that a person goes through. And the majority of girls who want to transition, if you don't give them puberty blockers, if you don't give them hormones, they will slowly, when they start maturing, they will realize this was only a phase. But if you give them puberty blockers, they don't have the mental capacity, because the brain doesn't develop because of the puberty blockers. Oof. They don't have the capacity to realize that maybe the wish to become another sex is only a phase. So,
so is there any debate in the Netherlands about this? Because it must be very hard to be critical in the country of the Dutch protocol, where it's very...
There is a debate. Sure.
That's good to hear.
Yeah, there is a debate. And there was a proposal for a law that people could self-identify, so that you could change your birth sex in your passport just without any inhibition. And that law, we stopped it.
Right.
So, because there was this law and everybody thought, oh, that's fine, okay. And then we said, yeah, hey, listen, if a man... the law as it is right now, you need to have a doctor who says, okay, I agree with this. So you just need to take one little step.
Mm. Which is still not much, to be honest.
It's not much. It's just a safeguard. Yeah. It's just a small safeguard. Because if any man can become a woman in one click, it means that also men who... are not trans, but who have other ideas, you know, who have other plans, can suddenly become a woman. I've heard from criminologists that serial rapists will do anything to get into contact with women.
Obviously.
They don't care. They will do anything. Pose as a woman, they're fine with that. So suppose a serial rapist changes his passport and he's now a woman. He gets access to rape shelter. He gets access to women's prison if he is convicted. He goes to women's prison. Can you imagine you are being locked up with a serial rapist who... So he gets access to women's counseling groups. So, I mean, it's not safe.
And just to be clear, these are documented cases, at least I know.
There are
from
a lot of documented
cases from the UK, the US. I don't know about the Netherlands, about these kind of abuses.
And we don't have cases like that yet. But I know a lot of cases from America. I mean, there, Canada, yeah. Britain. There are even action groups of ex-inmates who are fighting against it.
Mm-hmm.
Because they say, hey, it's becoming so dangerous for us. I mean, there are a lot of people who seriously want to become women, and you can trust them and they're fine. But there's also a portion of men who just want to take advantage of this situation. And it's dangerous for women. And, you know, so we explained to the Dutch public, listen, this law is just dangerous. You can't decide that you're all of a sudden a woman. We need to have some safeguard. And the only thing that a trans person needs to do is go to a doctor and ask the doctor to confirm, and then he can change his passport, or she can change his passport, her passport. But we need a safeguard for it. So there is a discussion. The law has been put on hold. I don't think it's going to be there. We have a very right-wing government right now, and they're very against it. I'm not so very happy with the right-wing government, but at least this is one of the things that they're kind of adamant about.
Mm-hmm.
And what, yeah, and of course the Dutch protocol giving puberty blockers to teenage children is a very dangerous thing. But Holland will be the last country where these people are, these doctors are going to admit that they did a dangerous thing. Because if they admit it, they will admit that they performed medical experiments on children. Because that's what they did. They performed medical experiments on children. Because nobody knew when they started to give puberty blockers to so-called trans kids. Nobody knew what the puberty blockers were going to do. And then in Sweden, they found out that puberty blockers mess with your bones, that you can get a less dense density.
Bone density.
Yeah, less bone density. Yes. And it can give you chronic pain for the rest of your life. And there are also signs that there is something happening in your brains due to puberty blockers. Medication has been on the market for a long time already and used for all kinds of different things, also for chemical castration.
Yeah.
And it also has been used for endometriosis, if I'm not mistaken. And then in the 70s, there have been already bad reports about it. So, and they use these drugs on children. And they're not old enough to vote. They're not old enough to drive a car. But they're old enough to decide that they're going to live as another gender. I mean, it's madness.
It's insane.
It's insane. Leave those children alone. Let them grow up first and then have another look. Because actually, we all know that puberty is a time that we feel uncomfortable in our body. And that we are looking for our identity, and we need that time to grow up, and the prefrontal cortex of our brain needs to grow. So let's just wait until they are 21.
Yes.
And even better, 25, then the prefrontal cortex will be full grown. It's often very normal for young kids to say, you know, to say that they are another gender. Nowadays, we have parents who are listening to it and who take the kid when it's 5 years old immediately to a gender clinic.
Yeah, and as you said, we are losing the idea of a tomboy. Just a normal girl who wants to do, in society's eyes, you know, boyish things.
Yeah.
Which means just having fun and not dressing up to feminine stuff and just, you know, freaking...
Because, I mean, the most sexist ideology I've ever encountered is trans ideology, because to be a woman seems to be about wearing skirts, wearing nail polish, and have long hair. Well, I've been a woman for 63 years now, and I'm not wearing skirts, I'm not wearing nail polish, and I my hair is not long.
You must be a man.
I'm a man. Listen, do you have a trans clinic here in Budapest? I think I should visit it.
Sadly, no, but Belgrade has one if you want to go to Serbia, sadly.
Well, I mean, we can laugh about it, but it's
not funny yet.
It's not funny.
No.
It's not funny at all, because young girls are being told that they are male, whereas they might just be lesbian. They might just feel uncomfortable in their bodies because they saw horrible porn. And thought, if this is what a woman is supposed to be, I don't want to be like that. They might have all kinds of other mental problems which need to be solved first. And then we can look. And what happens now that young women, as young as 16 even, they have their breasts removed. Totally healthy breasts. Yeah. And I also talked to detransitioners, people who thought they were trans, and then went back because they realized they weren't. And one of them had planned to have her breast removed. She didn't go through with it. And she says now, she says, you know, think about it. What would have happened if I have done it? I wouldn't have been able to breastfeed my babies. I mean, It's horrible.
You are not able to make those decisions that will affect your whole life. I mean, my arms are tattooed, which is also a big change in a body. But I'm really happy that I waited for until I was 30 when I decided, okay, I'm going to do this. I like this, whatever.
And but that's only a tattoo.
It's only a tattoo. It doesn't affect my fertility. It doesn't affect of my bodily functions.
We're talking about, and you know, and people will say, oh, she's transphobe. She's saying all these critical things. I'm not transphobe because I really feel for those young people. A few weeks ago, I had a long conversation with a trans girl, a boy who wants to live as a girl. And she told me, I will respectfully call her she. She told me that she is waiting for her operation to have a vaginoplasty.
Oh, God.
And I said to her, do you realize how serious this operation is and how often people get horrible complications? And she said, yeah, but I can't wait to have my vaginoplasty because she really thinks that the happiness will come from the vaginoplasty. But if you're not happy with yourself the way you are, no operation is going to help you. And I am so scared that there will be terrible complications because you read so much about terrible complications because this is such a complicated operation. So I'm looking at this lovely, lovely trans girl. She is a lovely person. But she's so unhappy. And I think you're going into a life where you will, for the rest of your life, take hormones that your body is not fit for taking. And you will have this horrible operation. And I can only pray to God on my knees that you won't have any things going wrong, because most of the times something will go wrong. And when I left that conversation, I just felt so incredibly sad. Because if this trans girl could accept herself the way she is, you know, somebody who really likes to go into this girl thing. And for her, girl thing is long hair, skirts, long nails, makeup. That's what she told me.
Yeah, I mean, this is what it was sold to this person as a concept, yeah. as a solution, as a something that will... But I mean, I've lived enough to know, spent enough time in therapy to know, and anybody who has common sense knows, changing your body will not...
No.
Fix whatever is wrong with you mentally or whatever problem you have mentally or accepting yourself or...
If you have a problem accepting yourself, you can change your body, but it will never be enough.
No.
Okay. For some people, I'm sure that for some people, taking the hormones and doing the operation will be a good solution. I think that is true. But what we need, apart from hormones and operations, we need really good therapy. We need to look into those children. We need to talk with them. What is going on? Why are you so disgusted with your body? What is really going on with you? And if we uncover the reasons and we treat the reasons and they still want to go through with it, okay. But we need to have good therapy first.
And we need to have safeguarding. And we need a society that tells children, you can have a colorful personality. You can have all the kinds of toys you want, girl toys, boy toys, whatever you want to play with. It's fine. You can be gay. You can love whoever you want.
You can be a boy that loves nail polish.
Yeah.
You can be a girl that hates nail polish. Nail polish is not a feminine thing.
No.
You know, it's just ridiculous. If feeling like a woman is that you feel like putting on nail polish or makeup or... I'm not a woman. You know? I'm not interested in that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
So, but what is feeling like a woman?
I don't know.
I don't feel like a woman. No. I feel like a human being. I feel like Renate van der Zee. I don't know what it is to feel like a woman. This is just an idea. It's not feeling like a woman. It's having the desire to be someone else.
Yeah, right.
But you can't be someone else. You have to deal with being yourself.
Last minutes. Unfortunately, I could talk to you for hours, and I'm so glad.
I could talk to you for hours. I'm so honored to be here in this incredibly beautiful building. I think Budapest is a marvelous city, and I meet somebody like you. I'm overjoyed.
Me too. I feel like I've known you for years and I love it. Your last thoughts, whatever you want to share with Hungarian audience, there's a really good people following this podcast who are interested in feminist topics, in any kind of topic that you would want to share to women, to anyone you feel
I mean, we started out this conversation. I mean, there's so many topics that I would like to, but we started out this conversation talking about porn. And I just want to say to all of these people who have porn normalized, integrated into their lives, you know, start realizing what happens to the woman. Start realizing what it means to watch violent porn, what it means for women, how dangerous it is. And the whole sex trade. Don't ever believe anybody who tells you that these women like it, that it is easy money, that prostitution is the oldest profession in the world. It is not the oldest profession in the world. And even if it were the oldest profession in the world, slavery is also as old as the world. And we've abolished that. So that something is really old and happened all the time, it doesn't mean that you can say that it's a good thing. So, you know, don't use women in prostitution. You know, don't think that it's fun, that it's nice. I know a Hungarian sex industry is huge.
Yes.
It's vulnerable women they're using and they're exploiting them. Don't go along with them. And if anybody say there's nothing wrong with prostitution or nothing wrong with porn, just say I don't agree.
Thank you so much, Renata. So much respect to your work. Thanks for being here and talking to me.
Thank you very much.